going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive. Up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
That's right, it is the Going Deep podcast. This is a very important edition of the podcast as we take time to reflect and hopefully learn as we pay respect for National Day of Truth and Reconciliation in our country. It is a civic holiday, but it shouldn't be one that is spent just not doing work, and essentially actually falls on a weekend this year. So many of us will have a weekday off, but really it should be spent thinking, reflecting, learning, reaching out, reading, going through the calls of action in the TRC report to understand how we can have reconciliation based on understanding the truth. And that's what we're hoping to explore and unpack in this episode through the lens, as always, through sport. We're going to talk to Ted Nolan, who's done much of that work in the sport of hockey, later on in the episode. But first, I'm going to play a little feature for you on Nateel Batiste. She is a boxer. She's an Afro-Indigenous Canadian from Acadia First Nation, where she's also a counselor and, sadly, a sexual assault survivor. And she discovered boxing as a tool for healing, not just from her own personal adversities and trauma, but for those of her ancestors. And as you hear, she's hoping to pass on the gift that she's found through the sport of boxing and not the trauma that she's been given to her offspring. So the first voice you'll hear in this feature is Nateel Batiste. After that, you will hear her trainer, Bridget Stevens. Take a listen.
When you walk into a boxing gym, the number one thing that you find out right away is everyone here has a story. We're all here because something brought us through those doors. You learn to control your mind and release the toxicity that has been put on you, and you place it into the ring, and you learn how to turn that violence into art, and then it becomes beautiful. Indigenous people shine in this sport, but Black people shine in this sport as well because of everything that has been placed in front of them. All those ancestors and everything that they went through, that's what makes up my DNA. It makes me such a strong person just with the blood that just flows through your body. So it's a beautiful thing. Indigenous people are naturally gifted in strength, and I will 100% stand by that. Indigenous people have always tested their limits. Boxing falls right in that. You need physical endurance, you need mental endurance, and you need to be able to be a you versus you type of mentality. And that's what started to break me out of my shell, because I was able to release what I was just holding in. And when I did that and I released that energy, I fell in love with the sport instantly.
Backwards up the stairs, you're doing great.
Nateel is the most kindest person that I know. Then she can switch things up, right? When the bell rings and when she goes into that fight mode, she could transform into a vicious, vicious animal. Each individual that comes into this gym has been treated really bad. They're all coming to me because they feel alone. We all learn to be able to defend ourselves and put a stop to every obstacle that was thrown at us. And I knew from the life experiences that she had, she doesn't give up. The grit that she has, people will spend so much time training and maybe never even get it. The fighter she is, she's got it.
I was born in Boston, Massachusetts. I moved to Nova Scotia in 2000. at that point in my life, I was moving to Canada to reconnect with my mom's side of the family, which is my First Nation side of the family. When I first moved to Canada, life had kind of flipped upside down. I was exposed to a lot of violence, a lot of sexual violence at such a young age, and moving into an Indigenous community and having that done to me. It's a reality for a lot of children that they go through that. When I look at the individuals that did what they did to me, it was done to them. It was done to their parents, because their parents were children in the residential schools having that stuff done to them. You have people who are now elders that still have never talked about residential schools, and that's such a normal pattern. I developed that coping mechanism to just not talk about it, never talk about what I went through, and holding it in is what brought me down such a rough road as a child. Life on the reserve was definitely different than life in the projects, where we're very faced with the similar things of poverty and, you know, crime and things like that, but I was automatically excluded from a lot of things. The reserve had a bad rep for people who didn't live on the reserve, so it wasn't like I could have school friends that wanted to come and hang out with me on the reserve because their parents wouldn't let their children on the reserve. There was never a time where one of those identities didn't prevent me in a certain situation. I didn't do sports and stuff in school just because it was a prevention of it. So when I did get into boxing, it was something that was very individualist. I don't have to work with a team that doesn't like me because of factors I can't control. I'm pushing myself as hard as I can push myself in a sport where it's me versus me. And it was the first workout, like just the release of everything and just realizing like, hey, I'm actually naturally good at this, and having that reaffirmation from the coach saying, yeah, that's really good, that was perfect. And I was able to talk back to the thought in my mind and say, no, I'm gonna make it through this 2-minute round. I'm not giving up. That was the first time I've ever challenged my mind in that sense. And when I did that and I released that energy, it was an amazing feeling. Once boxing was introduced to my life, there was no more bullying that was going on. I felt more power to defend myself, not in a violent way, but mentally be able to say, no, I'm not letting that person have that power over me. When it comes to intergenerational trauma, you have to identify it within yourself first. What are the things that you're going to be bringing into your relationship with your child? What traumas have you not addressed inside of your life that I may be putting onto her? So actually, when I was pregnant with her, that was my first time ever speaking up about it. Once you can watch yourself and your trauma that you've went through, and you know what things trigger it when you're projecting it and when you're not healed from it, then you can start to say, okay, I'm not going to put this on my daughter because she doesn't deserve that. So I'm gonna stop it at my generation, and I'm gonna do that homework that I wanna do within myself to make sure that that's not something I'm continuing and passing on to my daughter. Nevi has been in the gym 4 days a week, starting at 5 weeks, from days where she was sitting in a car seat, sleeping the whole time, to having a mat when she learned how to crawl. She's grown here. Everyone here really supported me in having Nevi grow up in the gym, where it's now her home. I had a fear that exposing her to boxing at such a young age might entice violence, but it really has done the opposite. She really has shaped such a strong mentality of just her own confidence being in the gym, and she loves the sport, and everyone here just gives love. She's just turned into such a caring person, which really, every boxer has such a caring heart. It's just that they also have a story of what brought them here, and they healed through boxing. So it's beautiful having her in the gym. You never know, you guys might be interviewing her in a few years.
Thank you so much to Nateel for her time and her story. Thank you to Carla Antonio, who produced and put together that story, one that gives us a moment to pause, to think, and to understand that what happened to the first inhabitants of the land in this country on Turtle Island in Canada is not something that just happened years ago. It's something that we still see the consequences of in our everyday life. Someone who's dedicated his life to helping others through sport is Ted Nolan. We catch up with him on this special edition of Going Deep after the break.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson has a show.
And I'm so happy that you're listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had a show. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Grandma and Granddad. Learned so much from them. I appreciate them as my elders. And that practice of appreciating and learning from your elders is something that is part of the bedrock of Indigenous culture. And someone who's been a great example of that, not just for Indigenous peoples, but for all of us, is Ted Nolan, who many of you know from a sporting context as a former professional hockey player and left winger, former head coach of the Buffalo Sabres and the Latvian men's national hockey team. But he's actually done even more post playing hockey to help others in the space. That's why he's created opportunities for Indigenous youth in sports via the Ted Nolan Foundation and Three Nolans. But in about a week and a half, on October 10th, his memoir will be released, Life in Two Worlds, where he goes even deeper into his journey from the reserve to the NHL and life beyond, and what some of the lessons that he learned the hard way that he's hoping to eradicate some systemic issues so that others coming up after him don't have to have the same difficult experience, both within the game of hockey, but really and truly within this country. That's the basis of the conversation that we have next with Ted Nolan. Ted, thank you for taking the time, and thank you for taking the time to really reflect and share some of your life lessons and your stories in this book. I wonder, first and foremost, putting it all onto paper is a daunting task, and it can be a difficult task. Why now? Why did you think this was the right moment?
Well, you know, I didn't really pick the moment. The moment kind of picked me. Penguin Books reached out. I did an interview on a sports show, and it was kind of around the truth and reconciliation about 2 years ago. And I got really, really emotional because of some of the things that happened. I never spoke about it before with that much detail. And someone picked up on it. And before you knew it, Penguin contacted me and see if I'd be interested. So I contemplated a little bit because, you know, a lot of stuff that happened to me, I kind of wanted to keep it a secret. But because of what transpired in the United States with George Floyd, and if you don't speak, I mean, you're not going to make a difference. I really wanted to make a difference, but I didn't want to speak too early because my two sons were still playing in the National Hockey League. Both Jordan was playing and Brandon was, he got injured early, but I didn't want my complaining to interfere with them and say, you know, here we go again. So I kept quiet, but timing is everything.
So funny to hear you say that, because you say complaining and really you are explaining and having that fear of repercussions, not solely for you, but, you know, for your sons. That's a difficult space to be. Walk me through the emotions of having to hold things, but also understanding a greater system, and that, you know, the punishment still can come just from being honest.
Well, you know, I'm glad you rephrase that, because it's, you know, I heard my whole life, you know, just get over it. I mean, a lot of people discuss some of their past, and you hear people say, just get over it. And how do you just get over it? So a lot of my refuge when I was growing up, because we had family members who attended residential schools. I myself went to day school, where we didn't have, at least we got to come home at nighttime, but the treatment that we got at these schools were still relatively the same. Then you hear stories about what happened to people at the residential schools that are general public now are just learning about. So it was a lot of stuff, and to bring it out and to talk about it, it was extremely hard. And so we took a little time to, and the more I talked, I was skimming over some of the details. I would just, because I didn't want to go there myself. And I'm going, that's a little bit too heavy. But then talked to my wife, and we talked about some stuff. We said, hey, if you're going to write a book, let's get to the truth of what really transpired. And so my story is kind of a story of a lot of kids of color that have to go through this on a regular basis and are still going through it. So by talking about it, hopefully I could make a difference on the next, not so much the kids coming into the space, but the people who are in that space will be a little bit more welcoming.
Was there one anecdote, one scenario or story specifically that was difficult to relive, that you really questioned whether or not you wanted to include it in the book?
Probably because hockey was my safe space, and all the stuff was going on, and my uncles were both severe alcoholics, and there was a lot of drinking in our home at an early stage, and a lot of times we didn't have too much to eat in the wood stove, I escaped that by going outside, going for a run all the time. That was my escape. And then when I got let go by the Buffalo Sabres, fast forward 15, 20 years later, and that got taken away, then all of a sudden everything just kind of popped on me. So it was the mental health thing that really, really got to me. And so just reliving some of those situations when you're a little boy growing up with a lot of adults are in the room, and they're drinking a lot, and there's a lot of fist fights and tables overturned. And so I did, that's what happened some nights in my own home. So I didn't want to share that with people, but I think a lot of our people went through those type of things based on some of the experiences that they had during residential school era. And that's one way they escaped their reality. So I looked at my two uncles from time to time. I always wondered what happened to them, what made them like this. So now I have a little bit, I guess a little bit more understanding. So I just really wanted to. So it was extremely hard to talk about that, but I knew I had to. So I kind of buckled down one day and looked at all the stuff that I went through when I went to Kenora. I loved the game of hockey before I went there. Then I just played to survive. And so I kind of used that mechanism that I had built in me early. I got to fight through it somehow. So what Penguin was very, Meg Masters, who was an angel helping me write the book and taking the time and going through some of that stuff was hard that I never shared before. So I think early childhood growing up and seeing some of the stuff that I saw through the eyes of others, particularly the elders in our community.
It's funny because some things that can make us strong and great, can be weaknesses. And you've talked about the need to compartmentalize, not focus on certain things, package them away and just focus, which theoretically allowed you to be a great hockey player, to get through pain, to get through distractions and focus. But at the same time, it allows you to bury some things that you would have seen or that your family would have experienced that would have been therapeutic to share. I want to touch on that journey because it is so remarkable and unlikely. Do you look back and think, how you went from day school to the NHL, really against all odds?
Well, you know, because we didn't grow up with a lot of those dreams. We just kind of went from day to day and what have you. But for whatever reason, I love the game of hockey ever since my older brothers were playing. They played on a senior team from the reserve that played in the city. So we went to watch them play all the time. And my big ambition was growing up to be a Garden River Brave on the men's hockey team. That was my extent of my vision. And I made a rink in my backyard. And I played, and I my father finally scraped enough money together to put me in recreation hockey. My skates were about size 8, my feet were size 3, and my helmet didn't fit properly. And we must have been quite a sight to look at. But you know, I loved to play, and the more I played, the better I got. And I never made any AAA hockey teams growing up or went to any hockey schools. I just liked to play. And then all of a sudden, before you know it, I was invited to a Tier 2 team out in the Manitoba Junior Hockey League. And then coming back and playing the Ontario Hockey League I had a chance to play with Wayne Gretzky and Craig Hartsburg and Greg Millen and a couple of, some really good players. And then just learning from them and just trying to, and then I just got better, and all of a sudden I got drafted into the National Hockey League that I didn't even know they had a draft, tell you the truth. I thought Wayne Gretzky came to Sault Ste. Marie because he wanted to play up there like I did, but I didn't realize they had a draft. And so I went in very naive, and I think that being so naive kind of helped me because I didn't know any better. I just so when I seen these guys, I thought I was just as good and I could be as good, and I just had to work. And then all of a sudden, I found out the reality of the sport and how it all works. And but thank God I made it through those early years.
And then you make it through not only as a player, but then you end up rising the ranks as a coach. People certainly celebrate your appointment as a coach and the representation that provides, which is needed. But I also mourn the fact that you only had one opportunity, especially when you look now that there are many coaches that are recycled time and time again who, quite frankly, have not earned more than one opportunity, that there aren't many of people of color coming up in the pipeline. But that's me on the outside looking in. How do you feel, having gone through the experience of being embedded in the sport, understanding your aptitude, with, you know, the state of coaching and the opportunity you had relative to the barriers you had to face?
Well, you know, growing up, understanding the barriers and seeing some of the people before me trying to, but for various reasons, they weren't picked on the team, weren't allowed to play. And I just really wanted to break that barrier. And I didn't, I just wanted to fight through it. And then when I got to the National Hockey League and I worked so hard to become a really good coach, because I had to work as twice as hard as everybody else to be a player, and I had to work triply as hard to be a coach. And then I really found I found my footing. This is something that I was really born to do. I just loved it. And when they took it away, I mean, that was the straw that broke the camel's back right there. I was so devastated. I'm going, because before you could fight that if they cut you from one team, you could try again, you could try again, you could try again. But hockey or coaching, there's only 20 odd jobs in the National Hockey League. If you don't get along with the people who are hiring, you're not getting in the door. So it was very frustrating. I didn't have any interviews early. Then rumors started that I was, of all the rumors that probably hurt the most was, you know, I was drunk at practice. I was lazy. You know, those type of things that were stereotypical of remarks that they threw to our people when they seen them down and out. So, and my mother was killed by a drunk driver. So that kind of really spin me back. And I'm going, how could somebody believe that? But they did, and they wouldn't. Well, we heard you're doing this, we heard you're doing that, and I couldn't get in not even an interview. So I took it hard. I went off the rails myself for a couple of years. I went in some very dark places that before it never really affected me that much. I just said, hey, I'll just try again, try again, try again. But for whatever reason, this one really took me for a loop. And it almost destroyed everything I worked for, my family, my relationship with my wife, my kids. And I just went to that really dark place. And then all of a sudden, one day I went to a movie, Muhammad Ali's story, with Will Smith. And for whatever reason, that movie kind of sparked a rejuvenation inside of me. I'm going, geez, this guy went through some difficult times. There's a lot of people that went through some very difficult times, but find a way to get out of it. And so I walked out of that movie a changed man. I said, you know, hockey is what I did. It's not who I am. And I started doing some other things. I developed the Rose Nolan Scholarship because my mother was so important to me. And we give out close to, you know, $2 to $3 million for scholarships for First Nation women. I developed a hockey school and got all that. And I was really, really happy. And all of a sudden, hockey starts again. Moncton, Robert Irving from the Moncton Wildcats gives me a call, which I didn't want to do. But his kind spirit and the way he wanted me to be a part. And this is my first time. I'm 36 years old now, going through all the experience. But that was the first time in my life that I felt wanted. He wanted to be a part of his team, so I took the job. And we were lucky enough to win. That led me back into the National Hockey League and even a chance to coach at the Olympic Games. But I'll tell you that that devastation when they took something away from you that you know you're good at, it was really hard.
Why do you think those rumors were circulated about you?
You know, I can only speculate. You know, I didn't get along with the management at the time. You know, we had our differences because I coach a different way than most, and I don't just rely on star players. I think they're very, very important, but as a team, I'm from a family of 12. And my parents felt they've loved me the most. They give me and then all of a sudden I heard my sister say it, then my brother say it. So we all felt that same thing, and that's why I wanted to coach. I didn't want to just be a special coach to the star players. I want to be a special coach to the guy who gets 2 to 3 shifts and let him know that he's important. So and then I was kind of told to play star players a little bit more, and which I naturally do because you have to win games. But that doesn't mean you don't give. So I just had different method, and we didn't see eye to eye. And then when it came push to shove at the end, the general manager got fired. People thought I was the reason for it. Then all of a sudden, a couple of months later, I was gone. So, but. It's hard, Donovan, because when people assume they know someone and assume that this is what happened, and that's the reason of this book. I really wanted the people to understand you can't assume about something that you don't know. You have to understand where they come from. And some of the, you know, I'm not happy with all the decisions I made. Certainly, I don't think there's anybody on this planet that is happy with everything they do. We all make mistakes, but some of us are prone to it because of the trauma and the mental health and the issues that we go through. And sometimes you use it as a protective mechanism. My parents, ever since I was this little boy, they told me never to trust the white people, never to trust them because of what happened to them. So I had mixed emotions going to school and making friends with kids from the city. Could I trust them? So it was always in my back of my mind. Then all of a sudden, Buffalo happens, and I'm going, they can't get rid of me. I proved I can coach. I just won Coach of the Year. There's no way. And they still did it. So then I kind of looked, and I said, well, maybe mom and dad were right. Maybe it is. But then I kind of revented myself and say, they weren't right. We just got to keep fighting, and eventually things will turn. And that's the reason why the book, I just want to, there's some young people like me right now that are probably going through same things that I went through in different circumstances. I just happen to be an athlete, but there's schooling, there's jobs, there's all kinds of different things. So hopefully they could learn that lesson a lot quicker than I did. I just learned it, you know, two years ago, and I was 63 years of age. I'm just kind of going through it now, and I feel so blessed to get through it. So with my experiences, hopefully I could have a little bit of an impact on the next generation.
Well, you're doing that with your Ted Nolan Foundation and Three Nolans, creating those opportunities for Indigenous youth in sport. What is the intended goal? What are you hoping these kids get out of what you and your family is doing with them?
You know, I think you have to have a carrot for any kid to get interested in something. I mean, you're just not going to come to a program. But if we happen to be from a First Nation community, we grew up, I'm the dad, I have two sons that played, and they all love hockey. So hockey is the trick to get them to the hockey rink. But when we get them to the hockey rink, that's when we could spread the word about whatever you want to do in your life, you could do. But it takes some hard work and it takes some discipline, and you're going to have to leave home and eating properly and getting some good rest at nighttime, making really good decisions when you become a teenager, and the importance of school and health. And so that's what our main goal is, not to develop the next NHL player. If there's one or two that comes out of it, hey, that's great. But we all know statistically how tough it really is to do it. But go to school and to work and to plan your future without some of the difficulties that their parents are going through my age, and they could have a better life. So that's the whole idea. And you got Jordan, my youngest boy, who, you know, he was part of three Stanley Cup rings, and he brings the rings, and Brandon played, and Brandon went to school and got his business degree and marketing degree. And Brad Jordan went back to school after he was done playing. He's now a registered fireman. So he hasn't been working in that field yet. And they both do Shoresy. They got this little TV gig. So it's kind of cool that they're from the same kind of place as they are. And the things that you can accomplish through hard work. So they just kind of talk about experiences that they had when they were their age, and little tricks on how to overcome it.
Well, it's cool between them that they can show them different possibilities and what the kids can dream to be. You didn't dream to be head coach in the National Hockey League. Hopefully, kids coming up now from First Nations communities do. When you look at the landscape and the pipeline, do you see opportunity? Do you see willingness to expand who we look for and who we promote in terms of leadership in the sport?
You know, it's changing a little bit, but not as much as I personally think that it should, because the hardest part, Devin, is when you don't know anybody and you're trying out with a local team in whatever city, and you kind of grow up together and you kind of play together, and all of a sudden an outsider comes in, and all of a sudden the coach knows six or seven parents on the team that they kind of grew up, and it's very hard for that coach to release one of those kids that they grew up with to let an outsider in. So it's extremely hard to crack that lineup. And we've always known that when we're growing up, we had to be not as good. We had to be better than to make that, team. And you know, our forefathers, seen that reason. And to this day, one of the best hockey tournaments I've ever been to in my life was the Little NHL. And we had Little Native Hockey League. It happens every March. And we make teams because we didn't have the experience of making a travel team and going in hotels and swimming in the swimming pool and going to rest, all that stuff. We didn't have that experience. So some of our leaders thought it would be cool if we created our own and we can go to hotels and we can get together and really partake of what sport is all about. And sometimes as adults, and we get caught up with the end result. Maybe you can produce the next Wayne Gretzky or next Bobby Orr, but they forget about everybody else. We just want to have fun at the sport and develop good citizens. And I think that's what sport really does. And sometimes we just get wrapped up on the end result and forget what sport is all about.
Lastly, sport can really teach us some good lessons and guide us in terms of some of the things we should be focusing on. You know, in our country, we have Orange Shirt Day, Truth and Reconciliation Day, a national civic holiday. You talked about the emotion that you had speaking about your reconciliation before. How important is it for the rest of the country, the settlers, to continue this conversation and find truth so that we all can find some reconciliation?
You know, I just think knowledge is the key to understand. And don't be so quick to judge. You know, we have you collect welfare, you're tax free, and all this junk that's out there. But they have to know what the truth is, and then about the residential schools and taking kids from our families and not allowing us to speak our language. Both my parents were speakers, but they never passed it on to us, and they didn't pass it on to us because they're afraid of. What happened to them could happen to us. So they're in a way that they're protecting us. But do I wish they would have? 100%. I wish they would have, but they didn't. So now it's up to us to kind of rebuild and reintroduce ourselves and to be proud of who we are and our languages and our cultures and to share it with the rest of the world. So all the survivors, you know, and I tell this to everybody. When I played that first game in the National Hockey League, I laid tobacco outside of the Chicago Stadium. Because it wasn't a game for me. I knew what I was going through, and I knew I had to fight through it, but I would never have been able to fight through it if the people before me didn't fight for what they believed in and to give us a better platform, a better space that we could continue. So they sacrificed a lot. And so when I had a chance to play this game for a living, I didn't think it was such a big deal. But the big deal is to prove to people that we can do whatever we want in any walk of life and to be proud of who you are instead of doing it behind closed doors.
Well, one of the most beautiful things for me as an observer of Indigenous culture is, one, the sport and activity as a form of medicine. And your story is an example of that, but also elders and their storytelling and passing on the lessons as a form of medicine. I'm not aging you. You're not an elder in that sense, but you have been so gracious to pass on the knowledge that you have received from your elders and from your experiences. So thank you and congrats on an outstanding piece of work with the book.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. Donovan, I just hope, you know, people will read this, and it's not just a Ted Nolan story. It's a story of a lot of people in our communities and what we had to fight through. And I was just one of the lucky ones that got through. But I didn't get through with the right way. I got through in spite. I didn't get through because I loved and I was welcome. So hopefully they read that, and the next time they see someone on their team or in the school or on the street or someone that they know, they could just be a little bit more understanding.
So that's just a snippet of the man, the legacy, the learnings, and the real-life application. For even more, go get his book on October 10th, Life in Two Worlds by Ted Nolan. So we have these conversations all of the time, and what I don't want to do is just center them around the people who have been victims in this country to find all the solutions for us. We don't do that for anything else. If we are looking to cure cancer or eradicate a disease, any solve, we don't just say, hey, victims, we're going to have a panel. Will you tell us your stories? We'd certainly do that to humanize it, which I hope we can do with this podcast. But we also ask experts in field, experts in industry, people who look over infrastructure, people who are public servants, to weigh in as well. And that's what we'll do with Pascal Saint-Ange, who many of you know because we've talked about how many things have gone past the Minister of Sports desk. That would be her formerly. She's now the Minister of Canadian Heritage. So who would have a better understanding of the role of sport and of culture to help shape these conversations and find truth and reconciliation in Canada? So we caught up with the minister herself, Pascal Saint-Ange, on truth and reconciliation and calls to action via sport.
So minister, great to be here with you where you get to see some of the work and you're not in Parliament. What's it like for you to be here amongst the athletes at MEG?
Oh, well, it's always special. First of all, to chat with athletes. We were just talking about this, but it reminds me, anyways, of the old days when I used to be an athlete and the lifestyle, the hard training and everything, the discipline, but also the camaraderie. How do you say that?
Camaraderie.
Anyways, the friendship. And yeah, all the friendship and the people that you meet when you're doing sport. And this is really what the North American Indigenous Games is all about. It's bringing communities together, sharing passion and love for physical activity and sport, and also sharing about culture and language. So it's been great so far.
Your first North American Indigenous yes. Games, what have you learned via your experience that you didn't know before?
Well, there's the fact that, you know, since I became a sport minister, and you know that reconciliation is a very big part of our government's work, and it's across all portfolios. And in sport, there's five calls to action that were brought forward through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that happened. And it's really about making sure, first of all, that the government supports those initiatives like the North American Indigenous Games. So I'm really proud that the government is helping and funding and making sure that 5,000 kids can actually come together and compete against each other, but at the same time share about their culture and language. So this is for sure part of the reconciliation process and path that we're walking together. But it's also making the appropriate changes so that sport is overall more inclusive. And removing barriers so that different communities, but for sure Indigenous communities as well, have access to sport.
Another big part of your work is safe sport.
Yeah.
How do you put in practice infrastructure for safe sport that makes sense or tailored to specifically Indigenous athletes and Indigenous communities?
Well, there's a few things. First of all, you know, talking about safe sport, it's a pretty broad definition. There's everything in there about abuse and maltreatment or harassment, and that applies for all. But there's also the fact that you know, when people come together to participate in sport, no matter the level, there shouldn't be any discrimination or racism or homophobia. So making sure that all our policies, because as minister, where I have the most impact is on policy. But so what we're trying to do is bring diversity at the decision-making table. That's why we brought in the governance code, so that we make sure that there's gender balance on those boards at the national level, but also that we make room for diverse communities, because sport should be really inclusive, and everyone, you know, all the decisions should be influenced by this will to make sport accessible to all. So having, for Hockey Canada, for example, when they renewed their board, there's now an Indigenous person that sits on the board and that can talk about the place that hockey holds in the First Nations communities and traditions. So I think it's making all organizations grow and get better.
Thank you so much to the minister for the candor and the time and the willingness to have the conversation, not just in front of people in Parliament, but to have it in a sports context as well. But the important thing also to recognize is that no one is too big or too small to make an impact, which is why I want to shed spotlight on Trishelle Bunn, who is a law student right now, but isn't waiting until she gets her law degree to make significant changes in our country. She was recently featured in Canadian Running magazine as part of the Under Armour Diversity Content Series. With that, she was donated some product naturally. She used her donation to gift every child on Birdtail Sioux Dakota Nation a new pair of running shoes. On August 18, she distributed 213 pairs of shoes and called it essentially Under Armour Day. Now, she understands the power of her sport. She's a varsity hockey player and law student at the University of Manitoba. She's also the female youth chief of Southern Chiefs organization. And this weekend, she's organizing a reconciliation half marathon to honor survivors of residential schools and to commemorate those who were never afforded the opportunity to return home. Like me, she's inspired by her grandparents. Hers were survivors of the Berto Residential School, as well as the 250 Indigenous children discovered at the former Kamloops Residential School. So we take time to talk to her about the impact of the generational trauma in her family and what she's trying to do via sport to change things. Rochelle, thanks so much for joining, and thank you for using your platform to organize and activate around the reconciliation run. Time is not something that you have a lot of. You are an athlete, you are a law student. Why was taking your time to do this something that was important to you?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I think, you know, obviously people always kind of take note that I'm kind of a busy person and I'm kind of expanding myself in all different areas. But I think for me, like, the main part and the main focus of, you know, everything I do, whether it's as an athlete or a student or like as like the youth chief of the Southern Chiefs organization or as the organizer of the reconciliation run, it kind of comes back to making sure that I'm taking responsibility and I'm fulfilling opportunities that my grandparents never had. So I think, you know, a lot of the opportunities that I'm afforded today, like even just being able to share their story on these kind of platforms and to share their stories that for so long no one believed and that were ignored by, you know, not only the Canadian state, but a lot of Canadians. So for me, just making sure that, you know, my grandparents' stories and voices are heard and that they're finally being listened to now is kind of my main motivation to make sure that, you know, no matter how busy I get or, you know, how difficult or challenging it may be, kind of balancing all the different things I'm involved in. My main focus is always making sure that I'm upholding those duties to my grandparents and also to my ancestors who really paved the way for me to be in existence today and to be able to have the platform and voice that I have.
What I love about what I've come to learn about Indigenous culture is that the stories from the elders is really the lifeblood of the culture, which makes it even more devastating when those elders are taken away. You mentioned your grandparents' story. It's one that I'm sure is not unique to you, but what is it?
So my grandparents, in my language of Dakota, grandmother is Cushy and grandfather is Onka. So my Cushy Mildred, my grandmother Mildred, and my Onka, my grandfather Donald, were students at the Berto Residential School. And like many, you know, First Nations children across Turtle Island, they faced a lot of harm and a lot of horrible things happened to them. And they faced all forms of abuse while at the Berto Residential School. But still, you know, their resilience has been passed down to me and I feel fortunate for that. But, you know, growing up, they didn't talk about their experience at residential schools a lot. And I think that kind of has to do with, you know, for so long. And, you know, even today, we're kind of seeing now, you know, the challenge of that some people, you know, there's still that residential school denialism. So there's still, you know, despite the 215 recoveries in Kamloops and the many that followed after that, and despite the 215 calls to action by the TRC, there's still some people who aren't, you know, believing this part of, you know, our history as Canadians and the ongoing impacts that it has today. But like I said, it wasn't something that they talked about often, but when they did, I think, you know, they did it to make sure that, you know, their truth was passed on and that me and my family could continue their truth on that journey. But the reconciliation run, which started as a healing walk in 2021, kind of originated from the words of my Onka Donald, who shared with me in one of his stories to me was that when he's at the Berto Residential School, he wanted nothing more than to run away and go home. So that's kind of was the birth of the healing walk and then now the reconciliation run. So going back to, you know, the ruins of the Berto Residential School and running and walking home back to my community of Burtale, you know, in honor of my Onka Donald, who wanted nothing more than to run away and go home himself. And all the children across Turtle Island who wanted nothing more than to run away and go home and, you know, never got the chance to do so on their own terms or never got the chance to at all. And something, you know, my Onka Donald shared, because, you know, when you're a kid and your grandparents are telling you stories, you'll often ask questions. But for me, it was always like, well, why didn't you try to run away? And, you know, he said that
he saw the consequences that his classmates faced when they made attempts to run away and to leave the residential school and go back to their families. So he never did make the attempt himself. So when me and my family first started the Healing Walk in 2021, and then now each year with the Reconciliation Run, we're in our second year. It's a really emotional day, just because, you know, we're doing something that, you know, so many kids would have given anything to do. And especially with the familial connection of my uncle, that was his wish. And to know that he never had the chance to do so, but I'm able to do so in honor of him is something that I hold really close to my heart. And it kind of works to, you know, reclaim that space and to kind of fulfill his wishes.
I find it intriguing that you are a hockey player. And I wonder if you spoke to your uncle about the sport and the role of hockey in residential schools. We know now that still the sport of hockey isn't the most diverse, but there are varied minds in terms of the role of hockey at residential schools being an escape from all of the atrocities that took place, or a tool to try and Canadianize people at residential schools. What is, given the history, your relationship with the sport?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really key question and kind of an important topic. And I think, you know, a lot of Canadians and, you know, other people who are familiar with the movie Indian Horse, they can kind of see how hockey kind of intertwined with the Indian residential school system. And for me, like, I started skating in my backyard with my dad when I was 3 years old. So it was kind of just something that I was born into, the sport. And, you know, my grandfather played, my dad played, I played. So for me, and like my dad, when he taught me, is, you know, like, he did teach sport as, you know, that outlet and that way to overcome barriers and challenges, and kind of gave me hockey in a positive way. So, you know, like the medicine wheel, the four quadrants, mental, physical, spiritual, and emotional. So my dad always told me, you know, you have to find a good way to stay balanced on the four quadrants of your medicine wheel. So find a way to stay balanced mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and physically. And for me, that was hockey. Like, you know, when I was having a bad day at school, or, you know, something was going wrong in my life, you know, hockey was always that constant that I could look to stay balanced. So that's kind of where the quote, or like the motto of the run, movement is medicine, comes in. Where for me, like, when I saw the other people across the country, you know, doing marches and stuff like that and walks, that kind of resonated with me as an athlete, of, you know, using your body and kind of using movement as that way of healing. In a way of reflection, because I know, you know, for me, like, I feel like my mind's the clearest when I'm on the ice, and like everything kind of slows down. So I think for me, you know, hockey and movement in any way is kind of that way, not only to escape, but to stay balanced and to stay grounded.
Well, you did use sport as a platform. You're featured in Canadian Running Magazine, part of the Armored Jersey Content Series. You took that product donation and donated it once more, and calling it Under Armour Day. Why was that the thing that made sense to you to do when you were being proud to make sure that you used that platform to help others?
Yeah, I think that just comes back to like kind of another teaching that was passed down to me. And it's, you know, your community comes first, and like, you want to do something that doesn't just benefit you, but benefits everyone else. So I think even now, the opportunities that I get to, you know, talk about their run, I always try to make sure that the focus is, you know, on my grandparents and making sure that their voices are heard. And I think, you know, when you do get these platforms, you have a duty to give back to, you know, your people in your community that have, you know, supported you to get there. So the Under Armour partnership and the Under Armour Day in Bird Hill was a great experience. And I'm so thankful to Under Armour, and I wish like so many people could see all the smiles on the kids' faces in my community. So many kids, you know, put on their brand new shoes and ran away with them on. And some kids said they're saving them for back to school. Some were saving them for their run. So even, you know, with the partnership with Under Armour that happened in the Canadian Running Magazine, the kind of diversity series kind of in particular said that they would do Under Armour would do a 5,000 product donation. But, you know, of course, like, Under Armour, over 213 pairs of Under Armour shoes is a lot more than $5,000. So when I had met with Under Armour and they told me that, like, oh, like, we'll give you some time to think about like what kind of product you want our donation to be. And kind of almost immediately I thought of shoes, just because, you know, obviously with the run and then, you know, back to school, but then also with the 215 recoveries in Kamloops, the symbolism was leaving small shoes, you know, in honor and remembrance of the children lost at the residential schools, at the hands of the residential school system. So the ideas of shoes kind of came to mind, and I shared that with Under Armour, and they didn't hesitate in saying, like, let's make it happen. And like you said, so I'm a law student, so I'm living in an apartment here in Winnipeg, and I come home one day and there's like 213 like pairs of shoes delivered to my door by my apartment. So I think, like, I can't state enough how emotional, but like completely like beautiful, like the Under Armour Day was in my community, and just knowing that I can do something good for the youth of my community, like in our future leaders. And I know so often, like when I talk to elders, like, you know, I'm still obviously considered a youth. I'm only 23 years old, but already thinking about giving back to that next generation and making sure that, you know, they're equipped for anything that they want to do and any dream that they have, but also making sure that I'm a good role model for them to know that, you know, all their dreams, you know, are achievable. And this is a cute story. It's a little bit off topic, but one of my little cousins, Genesis is her name. She came to, you know, my university graduation this past spring. And at the U of M, they have an Indigenous grad powwow where they celebrate the grads of all the Indigenous grads that year from the U of M. And, you know, we're graduating, and among my class, you know, was like people who had like a degree in criminology who were going on to law school, or political studies who were going to law school, or, you know, medical school, or, you know, people that were going into social work. And there's such a wide, broad variety of fields. And I told her, like, she's only 5 years old, but I said, like, just remember that today is proof that you can be anything that you want to be and that the world is yours. And I think for so often, that's what, as Indigenous and as First Nations people, we were denied, you know, to see ourselves represented in all those different fields and sectors. So I think now just making sure that I'm a good role model in any way that I can be to, you know, let the youth in my community and any other youth who kind of hear my story know that anything that they want to do is possible.
Beautiful. I want to circle back to something you said at the beginning and about the responsibility for you. But ultimately, the real responsibility should be on settlers in terms of finding truth and then taking steps towards reconciliation. In your mind, what is the importance to not deny what happened, to seek further understanding, to use a civic holiday for steps towards reconciliation, not just by members of the Indigenous community, but in fact by everybody else?
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I know, like, obviously, you know, a lot of conversations, like, between Indigenous people is, you know, we often carry that burden of having to, you know, promote reconciliation and fulfilling, duties that, you know, will work towards reconciliation. But I think, you know, one of my biggest tips or kind of advice, I guess, to, like, non-Indigenous people around, you know, September 30th and even Indigenous People's Day in June is to make sure that you're committing and you're reflecting on that day of how you can make truth and reconciliation and uplifting Indigenous voices and Indigenous stories and Indigenous people, et cetera, you know, 365 days a year, not just on those, you know, maybe 2 days that work to honor Indigenous peoples, but that you're making that a part of your everyday life. And I kind of have an emotional story to share, I guess, that kind of connects to this question. And I get a little emotional when I talk about it, and it is a little personal, but last year, you know, was the first year of the reconciliation run. So we had the healing walk in July of 2021, and then the first reconciliation run happened on September 30th, 2022 last year. And leading up to the run, I had a woman from BC email me, and she had asked me if it would be okay if she came to the run. And I think even with the healing walk, and then even last year with the run, there was a little bit of hesitation from the non-Indigenous community of whether, you know, they were welcome to come and be a part of the reconciliation run. And I think, like, one thing that I aim to do is to make sure that, you know, anyone I speak to knows that they're welcome to attend. All backgrounds, all walks of life are welcome to attend the reconciliation run, to, you know, whether you're an Indigenous person and it provides that healing for you, or if you're, you know, non-Indigenous and you're coming there to reflect and to learn and to commit to truth and reconciliation, you know, the reconciliation run is a place for you. So I said, yeah, of course. And, you know, through the email, she shared with me that she was non-Indigenous and she'd be flying from BC to, you know, Winnipeg and then driving to Birtle. So that was quite the trek. So I was a little surprised. I was like, oh, wow, someone wants to fly, you know, from BC all the way to Manitoba for the run that I'm organizing. And I thought that was like pretty spectacular that it had that wide reach. And I was at the finish line of the run last year, and I was putting, you know, participant medals on each runner who came in. And finally that woman who had emailed me, she crossed the finish line, and I put a medal over her, and she gave me a hug, and she asked if I could talk to her for a little bit. So she pulled me to the side, and like I said, she was non-Indigenous, and she looked pretty emotional, and she was kind of getting teary-eyed, and she's like, I have to tell you something. And I was like, okay. And she told me that, she said, I just wanted to let you know that, you know, my grandfather was at the Brodo Residential School the same time as yours. And immediately I was taken aback, because, you know, my head's kind of spinning, and I'm thinking, like, she told me she was not Indigenous, so how would her grandfather be at the school? And then finally, like, I think once, you know, my brain settled down, I kind of, you know, made the connection. And she wanted to say that her grandfather actually worked at the Brodo Residential School. So there was her, and there was me, and, you know, both of our grandfathers had passed on, but we were both standing there, you know, on my community at the finish line on Bertel Sioux Dakota Nation that day. And both of our grandfathers could be placed in the Brodo Residential School at the same time and have, you know, completely different experiences. And that had completely different impacts on both of our lives. And she said to me, and this is something that I like to share, and it has really resonated with me, is she said, so many times people talk about reconciliation, but truth comes before reconciliation. I'm here today to own my truth. And I think, you know, as an Indigenous person, as a First Nations woman, that really resonated with me, because, you know, so much leading up to, you know, September 30th, it's, you know, First Nations people like myself and many of my relatives who are, you know, sharing our truths and our family's truths. But there she was that day as a non-Indigenous person owning her truth and her family's legacy and impact on the Indian residential school system. So I think, you know, for me, that just speaks to, you know, almost a way that, you know, non-Indigenous Canadians can not only take part in reconciliation, but also owning their truth and their family's impact and legacy of the Indian residential school system. So I think really kind of making that reflection inward and thinking about how maybe if you didn't directly contribute, but how your family has contributed to the residential school system or, you know, colonialism in general, and just really committing to learning, but also unlearning. So kind of reflecting inward and thinking, you know, what biases do I withhold inside myself? Which kind of stereotypes do I hold inside myself? And what am I willing to unlearn? And what am I willing to learn? So I think that's kind of my biggest advice and kind of perspective on, you know, the duty of First Nations people, but also the duty of non-Indigenous people on September 30th and the rest of the days of the year in terms of truth and reconciliation and making sure Indigenous people's voices and our rights and our treaty rights are upheld and valued.
Well, I know sharing your truth is not easy, and I know that we all benefit much more from it than you do. So thank you for sharing, and thank you for your commitment to speaking truth to power. Enjoy the run.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Trishelle Bunn. No matter what you're doing this weekend, whether you are taking part in a reconciliation run like the one that was just discussed, or you are taking time to be still, sit, and reflect, be sure to use the time. It's not just a civic holiday like any other. It is a really important step. It's in our calls to action in terms of how we can make steps collectively towards reconciliation. Thanks for listening.